From the Sky News Centre at 5, a series of emergency calls recorded moments after the 7-7 attacks reveal confusion between tube staff and the London Underground Control Centre. The tapes have been played at the inquest into the bombings. At first, operators believed the explosions are down to a power failure, but it becomes clear something more sinister has happened when they hear reports of a bang and walking wounded.
Hello, this is Supervisor at Aldgate. Will you please get as many ambulances as you can here?
Right.
We have injuries.
Yeah, in what respect, sorry?
We've got the police are requesting ambulances as well. All I've been told is there are serious injuries.
The commander of NATO forces in Afghanistan, General David Petraeus, has admitted that a British aid worker may not have been killed by her captors after all. There are reports Linda Norgrove may have died when a grenade was thrown during a rescue attempt by American troops. Foreign Secretary William Hague has been updating MPs and says she was a dedicated individual doing a job she loved.
The Prime Minister and I are utterly determined to do everything we possibly can to establish the full facts and to give Linda's parents a full account of the tragic circumstances in which their daughter died.
The first test capsule has been sent down the escape shaft to the 33 Chilean miners trapped underground. It's part of the crucial final preparations before officials try to start bringing the men up at about 4 o'clock on Wednesday morning, UK time. The men have been trapped in the mine since early August. The boss of Topshop and BHS says he's uncovered a staggering waste of money after investigating government efficiency. Sir Philip Green was appointed by David Cameron to review spending by Whitehall and beyond. He concluded departments often had little idea how much cash they were getting through. George Michael has been released from prison. He's thanked everyone who helped him get through his 4 weeks behind bars for drug driving. And in football, Rio Ferdinand says he's happy to return to the England squad as captain. He takes back the armband from Steven Gerrard, who had been standing in for him. That's the latest. I'm Richard Suchet.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
In 1985, Matt Setback Taylor and Dan Theodore Caswell were placed in a maximum security prison for a crime they didn't commit. They promptly escaped, only to find themselves trapped in the past, facing mirror images that were not their own, driven by an unknown force to change history for the better. Now, every Friday they present The Erotic Toast Project, Bristol's only alternative music and adult baking show. If you can find them, if you fancy a piece of toast, maybe you should tune in.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
Hello and welcome to Home Truth Special on BCFM's John Peel Day with me, Lynette. Coming up in the next hour, we've got some classic clips from the show, as well as an interview with one of the producers of Home Truths, when we'll hear some behind-the-scenes stories of how the show is put together. Well, fans of Home Truths will recognise that music. It's Let's Go Trippin' by Dick Dale, King of the Surf Guitars, and the unmistakable theme tune for Home Truths. Now, John Peel didn't just rule the airwaves on Radio 1. He was also the indisputable king of Radio 4 on Saturday mornings, as well as collector of obscure surfing tracks.
Bowler hat from Locks of St. James.
You never see those now, do you? You never see a bowler hat.
Never. Mm. I decided I'd wear it again, and I put the thing on, and it fit. Mm. It was too small. So I took it back to Locks, and I said, can you make it larger? And he said, no, sir, I'm afraid your head has swollen. And he led me to the door, out into St. James, and that was the last thing I heard of it.
The standards have slipped all round.
Bloody awful. Yeah. And then I went into another place in German Street to buy a trilby, and the fellow was dealing with me, and I heard the door going, and the door opened, and a big man came in, and it's kind of violet plus fours and a monocle. And the assistant saw him and he said, oh, my dear general, can I help you? And he completely abandoned me.
Yeah.
He just completely dropped me, and I walked out.
Yeah. Where do you stand on baseball caps?
A hat has got to have a brim.
I mean, what sort of hat is that?
Well, that I bought in a French market. It's a rather neat little number.
Yes, it is.
Imperméable, of course.
It gives you a slightly Gallic appearance.
Yes, well, yes.
What style of hat is it, though?
I call it a trilby.
What's it made from? Is it?
It's made of Scotch material. It's very, very nice.
May I?
Make me an offer.
No, no, I wasn't going to make it off.
Oh,
I just wanted to fondle it. Oh, yes, I see.
Yes.
It's quite a handsome...
You know, anybody who's, say, lives in Suffolk, for example, should be without a hat like that. Because living as we do in Northern Europe, where it can be ferociously cold in winter, by the way, it's an acknowledged fact, of course, that the greatest heat loss is off
the top of your head.
So why the bloody hell does people wear one?
When you're wearing your hat, if you meet an acquaintance or a lady in particular, do you doff?
Do I dove? Always. It's like Pavlov's dogs.
Yes, you know, automatic response.
Automatic response, I think.
Yes, I see. I've never been much of a hat person myself, but I have a similarly Pavlovian response. I always walk on the outside.
To protect the woman against the hackney carriages going past.
Well, there are different theories about this, aren't there? I mean, one of them, the one that I prefer, is that if we're set upon by footpads, I can push her against the building and defend her virtue with my sword. But, I mean, all the joking aside, I take it you are genuinely saddened that fewer people wear hats.
I am extremely saddened because I don't think an ensemble is really toot without a hat. Did your pa wear one?
Oh, I had loads of them.
Loads of them.
My younger brother is an avid hat wearer. I had breakfast with him this morning and he turned up wearing a hat which was a bit of a traffic stopper, I have to say.
Was it?
Well, very broad-brimmed.
Oh, really?
Yes, you might have regarded it as a slightly frivolous hat.
I wonder where he'd pick that up.
I don't know, but he wears it most frequently with one of those extraordinary Australian shepherd's long coats.
Long coats.
Yes.
He's quite clearly the black whatever.
Black sheep of the family.
Well, I wasn't going to say
that. He's a likeable boy, but...
Aberrant.
Aberrant, no question about it.
OK, well, that was a classic John Peel conversation about hats, obviously. Now, I've jumped ahead a bit, but I just want to go back and explain a little bit about the birth of Home Truths. In a meeting with the executives before Home Truths started in April 1998, John laid down just one ground rule. He said, "I just ask one thing, that you don't try to turn me into a Radio 4 presenter. I am who I am, and I don't particularly want to change now." And thank goodness they agreed. They also agreed that Home Truths would be a celebrity-free zone. And the show went on to run for 6 happy years, and it was an enormous success for Radio 4. For many listeners, it became a Saturday morning institution, and you never knew what you were going to hear. But you were always guaranteed a laugh, either from John's quirky introductions and asides, or the compelling conversations he had with the contributors. Here's some of his introductions.
Go drinking!
Hello again. This has been a week in which I'm sure I'm not alone in taking solace from the belief on the US evangelical right that there is no such thing as global warming because God wouldn't let it happen. As I climbed ladders in the monsoon that raged around Stowmarket on Monday and attempted to unblock the gutters as the lightning flashed, my faith in this belief did waver slightly and I wondered whether God, whose eye is, I know, upon the sparrow, might not have wearied of our greed and duplicity and general unpleasantness and decided to get rid of us ASAP in pretty much the same way as we get rid of wasp, hornet and ant nests. What next, I wondered aloud to Sheila. Are plagues of locusts even now massing just over the horizon, in Buxall perhaps, or Battersford? And tomorrow we'll be phoning helplines seeking advice on getting winged things out of expensive stereo equipment. Winged things showing, as your locust does, pronounced density-dependent polymorphism. Apparently, this density-dependent polymorphism involves forming mobs of nymphs and adults which migrate by day in a uniquely itinerant mode of life, mating and reproducing as they travel. Sounds like more fun than inching your way along a flooded A1M, for sure. But into this chaos and unreason flies Home Truths, with general loveliness and healing in its wings.
That's the unmistakable way of with words that John Peel had. And he really did have a talent, and I think he had a surrealness that was akin to Monty Python. And it was really through Home Truths that I got to know John Peel, having missed his Radio 1 years growing up in Australia, although his legend had even filtered through there. And the idea behind the show was simple. ordinary people telling extraordinary stories, or ordinary stories in extraordinary ways. It really elevated the everyday and mundane to new heights, often proving that truth really is stranger than fiction. Now, I tracked down one of the producers of Home Truths, Dilly Barlow, and asked her what she thought was behind the show's success.
I think the secret to Home Truths was very largely to do with John Peel and the way he presented it. The point about Home Truths was, unlike any other programme on the radio, it didn't have any celebrities on it. Every single person who contributed to the programme were, in inverted commas, ordinary people, because, as John believed, and as the team working on it believed, everybody has a story to tell. You know, no matter how large and amazing and heroic, or no matter how small and tiny and mouse-like, you know, it's interesting because that is part of people's lives, and I think that's what people connected with, and it's certainly what John was very, very good at honing in on, because he had the most remarkable, I think, sense of humour and sense of the bizarre and sense of the curious and a curiosity about other people's lives without being prurient. And he had his own unique way of eliciting their stories from them.
Interviewing was at the heart of the Home Truths.
Mexico, land of sun and romance and the strumming of a thousand times a thousand guitars, and a destination of special interest for Robin Bailey, who grew up hearing his grandmother's tales of his great-grandfather's exploits down Guadalajara way in the late 19th century. This great-grandfather was Arthur Greenhalgh. Arthur was married to a Lancashire beauty named Maria, but if you keep up with the twists and turns of his story, you'll discover that he also had a lover called Maria and at least one daughter called Maria. Think West Side Story's I Just Met a Gal Named Maria, but don't dawdle on the say it's soft and it's almost like praying stuff, or you'll lose the thread. Robin came into Broadcasting House to tell me all about it, and we started with a quick glance through some old photographs he'd brought with him, and he then told me of the departure from his home in Victorian Lancashire of great-grandfather Arthur, or Arturo as he became known, who, by the way, grew a magnificent moustache upon arrival in foreign parts.
You see, somewhat confusingly, everyone was called Maria. So his wife was called Maria, the one from Lancashire. His lover was called Maria. His daughter that he had with his wife, first one, was called Maria. His third daughter, the one in Mexico, was also called Maria. Maria Ella.
OK, so Arthur and Maria one had issue, did they? They had children?
They had one daughter who was born in Mexico.
Oh, OK.
OK.
So where did Maria two come into the proceedings? Although the child was called Maria as well.
Yeah.
So actually the child is Maria two.
Yeah.
So we're looking at Maria 3.
We're looking for Maria 3, yeah.
OK, so how did Maria 3 get involved?
That was when Maria 2 was about... She was about 2 years old, and she wasn't doing very well. She was...
A sickly child.
A sickly child, yeah. Okay. Wasn't doing so well, so they took her home. And then he went back alone.
OK.
And then it was in that time that...
He met Maria 3.
Maria 3, yeah.
So your grandma is Maria 2?
No, she's Ruth.
Where did Ruth come from?
She was born just after my great-grandfather went back to Mexico for the second time.
Yeah, OK. So, how did he meet Maria III?
She lived in one of the cottages. So they were neighbours, and they both worked in the factory.
And was Maria IV the only result of the relationship between your great-grandfather and Maria III?
Yeah. But the reason there's so many of... there's about 300 relatives now.
Yeah.
The reason there's so many is that Maria IV had 11 children.
How many of them were called Maria?
None.
Oh, okay.
None.
Breaking the family tradition.
Yeah.
And so did Maria I know of the existence of Maria IV?
I think she knew something. And I think also that their daughter, Maria II, she also knew something.
Right. So why exactly did he leave Mexico the second time?
Simply because he was going to be killed if he didn't.
That's a very good reason.
He left at the beginning of the Mexican Revolution.
Right.
Which he kind of helped to start.
Had he... In what way? Had he fomented revolution, or had he so annoyed the natives that they decided, let's have a revolution and sort this one out?
He had previously been, I don't know, blackmailed or been asked for protection money, whatever you want to call it. He'd left a bag of silver in a forked tree. Of course, I told the Mexicans that, and then we wanted to look for the forked tree.
Yes, I bet they would do, yeah. So when he came back from Mexico with the revolutionaries standing on the shoreline, waving their fists, as it were, he got back together with Maria One.
Yeah.
And did Arthur... Did he ever sneak back to Mexico later on in life just to see what was going on with his family there?
No, all contact was lost. So when I turned up, there was like a nearly 100-year gap.
So are you saying that all of the people in this village are called Greenhouse?
Yeah, I mean, it's a slight exaggeration. They're not all called Greenhouse.
But on the other hand, that is fairly extraordinary.
It is extraordinary, yeah. Hmm. And they all remember the handle on the star.
I can see why they would, having seen the photograph. I don't remember it. I'd probably wake screaming in the night.
That's typical of a Home Truths story. And not just was it the many Marias that you had to contend with, but this extraordinary story of this man's ancestor who was in Mexico and part of the revolution and et cetera, et cetera. It was just hilarious and interesting at the same time. And you can hear John, almost hear him concentrating, just trying to keep up with the Marias 1 to 4. He had the most extraordinary gift for eliciting stories from people. And I asked Dilly about his interviewing technique. Interviewing was at the heart of the Home Truths. And was John a trained interviewer? Did he have any experience? Has he got any journalist background that helped him in that way?
As far as I know, I don't think John had any journalistic background in terms of interviewing people, because John had always done his own thing. He had just introduced records in his own inimitable manner, by himself in a studio, and didn't really have much to do with anybody else. And so he developed a very, very unusual and unique style of interviewing people. And I think to understand the way in which he did it, you have to understand he was incredibly shy. I mean, he really was genuinely shy, and he would say that he was, and you think, oh, well, no, he can't be. But he actually was. But actually, when you got them in the studio, he was always absolutely fine. But his technique, really, was... In order to relax them, he'd suddenly, somebody would say, that would trigger his own anecdote. And he would just go off on his own anecdote. And, of course, you have to remember that most of the people that came on Home Truths thought John Peel was the hero. They could not believe they were speaking to him. So what he was saying to them was far more interesting than the story they had to tell. So quite often you'd end up with them asking John to continue his anecdote. And we were sitting behind the glass saying, John, can you just sort of get on with the story? And so he duly would. But then at the end of the interview, and the interviews never lasted, I would say, less than 40 minutes. They would go out on air at about between 8 and 10 minutes, so there was an awful lot of editing to be done. The thing he hated most was at the end. So you get to the end, and then he'd say, well, that was great, that was fantastic. I'm just going to have to ask my producer if there's anything else. So you say, actually, John, there was that question in the middle where you sort of went off. Could you just ask that one again? Then you say, my producer wants me to ask this question again. I think you gave a very good answer, but she wants me to ask it again. But, of course, in order to get the reason why the contributor was on, you'd have to ask him to ask it again. And then it always worked, and he was always very good. And actually, he was fantastic, and he was very, 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 you know, sympathetic. And once somebody started to tell their story, he responded actually really very well. And as he would often say, I mean, he was wont to cry. Tears came easily to John, and quite often in the middle of an interview, tears would come pouring down John's face. And it was usually the interviewee that had to end up comforting John and say, it's all right, well, we'll just move swiftly on.
OK, well, the following clip is really classic Home Truths, and I don't think it'll bring tears to your eyes unless they're tears of laughter. It's an interview with a couple who are both humanist celebrants, and I did think twice about including it because they talk about taking funerals, so it's inevitably poignant. But John has such fun talking to them, and they really are the quintessential eccentric characters that Home Truths had such a talent for unearthing.
John Bosley and Nina Boyd are husband and wife, humanist husband and wife at that. Humanism, they explained to me, is about living life without religion. And they aren't just humanists in the privacy of their own home. They officiate at funerals and weddings for people who don't fancy a religious service. John and Nina married 4 years ago and feel that their shared philosophy has brought many benefits to their life together. They came into our Leeds studio to describe these benefits, and I started our conversation by inquiring whether John had had a religious upbringing.
I did, yes, school choir and server at the altar.
Were you a believer at this stage, or like most children, just went along with it?
I can say I got doubts when I was about 16.
And at what stage did these doubts become concrete, as it were?
Well, I stopped church then, really, but it's taken me another 50 years to get to this, I suppose, convinced atheist.
Basically. Right, so what prompted you to become a humanist?
Well, I'd been to a couple of funerals that annoyed me, and I thought, I started thinking about dying. I wasn't ill, you know, but I thought, I want my children to do something better than that, and I just found a book called Funerals Without God, and it was published by the British Humanist Association. When they sent it me, I realised that I was a humanist, so I joined.
How long ago was this, John?
About 10, 12 years ago.
And how did you meet Nina?
At a funeral. The BHA does training for people who want to take ceremonies, and then they have to be observed, and I went to Lawnswood in Leeds. Mm. Basically to see her do a funeral.
What about you, Nina? What was your religious background?
Oh, just being sent to church by Mum and Dad to get me out from under their feet. But I think I've always been an atheist.
So what appealed to you about humanism, then?
It's atheism for people who want to make a contribution.
And what did you think of John when you first met him?
Absolutely horrible. Very loud-mouthed, and he looked like a tramp in those days. He had long hair and a long beard, and he sort of took pride in this wild man appearance, and it just didn't suit his personality. He's now Sean, much better looking.
I'm John.
Well, that is Sean in...
Oh, God.
And he's loved, which makes him a much nicer person.
Either of you been married before?
Yes, we've both been married twice before.
What sort of a wedding did you have? Is there a humanist wedding service? Or?
Well, yes, there are. I took one last weekend, but we didn't. We went down to Huddersfield Register Office with Nina's, one of her sons, and one of my daughters as witnesses, a little meal in Solimio, and then that was it.
How come you didn't have a humanist wedding?
Didn't want one. It's private. We just got married to each other. It was a private moment.
And so how many funerals do you do in a week, on average?
Oh, one or two, sometimes three if we're very busy, but
yeah,
I guess about 60
us.
To 80 a year.
But what is a humanist funeral, sorry? Would you just say, well, Dave's dead and now we're putting
him
on the ground?
No, well, the thing is, although it's called a humanist ceremony, it's not laid down from above. So when I say above, I mean the BHA office,
yes,
of course.
Laterally.
Yeah, so we all write our own based on, the bottom line is, there are no hymns or prayers, no reference to God, and no afterlife. So that's where one is starting from.
But what about weddings? Let's have an uplifting moment. You do weddings as well, you implied.
John does weddings. I don't, because they're not serious enough for me.
How do you mean weddings aren't serious enough?
I think being married is serious, but getting married, it's just a party, isn't it?
Well, I mean, a good party is a good party, though, as
yes,
I'm sure it
true.
Says in Leviticus chapter 14.
Yeah.
OK, well, taking the most recent ceremonies at which you officiated, did you, John, have any criticism over the last one you saw Nina do?
No.
He always praises me to the skies.
But I would say things like, if your voice drops a bit, we would say that to each other. Nina said that to me. She said, there's one or two words I couldn't hear at the back. It's worth knowing.
You sound
that.
As though, yes, of course it is. Yeah, you sound, Nina, as though you'd be more, this is a very hasty judgment, but you sound as though you'd be more likely to be critical than perhaps John would be. So what would you have criticised about his recent performances?
Oh, pace. You know, sometimes he slows down. I don't find much to criticise in him.
But it must help after... I mean, it must be fairly emotionally draining doing particularly a funeral, I would have thought. I mean, it's useful, presumably, to have each other to talk to.
Yes, but it can get too much. You have to call a halt, wrap ourselves round a glass of wine.
Or a game of Scrabble on the computer.
We're such boring people.
No, no, I'm as old. I don't do Scrabble on the computer, but the glass of wine I can identify with. Have you thought, without wishing to introduce a further note of melancholy into these proceedings, but have you thought about your own funerals? Presumably the one that survives will conduct the other's funeral.
Would we?
Don't know about that.
We haven't thought about this.
Yeah, we've talked about it.
Yeah, we talk about it a bit. I'm not really interested. When I'm dead, I'm dead.
Well, no. We'd almost rather not have a funeral, you know? I'm talking about with the body. Mm. I mean, you can do this by in law. You could say to a funeral director, I want you to dispose of my wife's body, assuming she's dead, you know. I want you to dispose of my wife's
better
body.
Better that way, I think.
And, yeah. But then they just do it and you could have a party.
I want to have a kind of rather old-fashioned tomb and things at which long-haired maidens can come and weep in diaphanous clothing.
But you won't be there to enjoy it.
I can derive some pleasure from thinking about it now. You know, you have to find your pleasures where you can, after all.
Wouldn't you rather be used as some sort of compost, to help a rose tree grow?
No, not at all, no.
I mean, wouldn't you rather be, say, cremated with all your record collection? Mm. Or am I getting...
It would take weeks for the flames to die down. A little creme humour for you there.
Yes, and what a double act. That's absolutely incredible. But here's Dilly Barlow, one of the producers of the show, with some more behind-the-scenes revelations from the Home Truths HQ.
He had a little ritual, and it was always the same. So he'd come in the morning, and somebody, of course, because there was always... Everybody said, well, what do you want, John? But it was always the same. He always wanted a smoothie and a croissant, I think he had, and a large... I think it was a latte or was it a cappuccino? Anyway, we started off the day with that, and he'd sit there and eat it. And then a little bit later, because, you know, he had diabetes, he'd get his drug paraphernalia out, and he rather liked to do this, and he particularly liked doing it if there were new people in the office, because it was a big open-plan office, and then he'd sit there and he'd get his needle out and bare his stomach and then jab himself. It just amused him. The fact that he was actually doing this, and of course because he worked in the music biz, and I don't think he'd ever touched drugs in his life, but the fact that he'd got this big needle out and appeared to be injecting himself, that appealed to his rather wayward sense of humour, that it might just open a few eyes. And he'd say, I've just got to take my drugs, in quite a loud voice. He had a fantastic sense of humour, and I think it was that sense of the bizarre and the peculiar and the idiosyncrasy that he liked. One of the things that I think was an unbelievable gift and a talent was his writing. It was amazing. As I said, we used to do these sort of dummy scripts, and, you know, we'd think we'd do it in sort of Peel style. And the biggest accolade you could possibly have was if he used one of your lines, which very seldom happened, but if it did, you're, ooh, he's used one of my lines, that's fantastic. But you'd write what you thought was a reasonable script, and he would turn it into pure gold. He just had the most wonderful style, and he was very, very, you know, where we might use 11 words, he'd use 3 or 4, or he was just very good at actually getting something in a nutshell and putting it really elegantly, but really amusingly, and in a way that only sort of Peel could say. And I think his scripts were pure works of art and works of genius, actually.
And welcome to another Home Truths. Each week I arrive in our office on the 8th floor with my ample bosom heaving with optimism, a spring in my step, my eyes upturned towards the stars, certain that this week we will do great things together, effect some sort of moral advance to match the technological advances that threaten to engulf us all. And what do I find when I sit down, manly features aglow with moral purpose, to consider your letters, emails and text messages? Chickens and nail clippings, that's what I find. Before we start, I need to talk to you about breasts and David Essex. I occasionally find myself in London with time on my hands on a Wednesday afternoon and have taken to going for a slightly forlorn court run by a group of fairly mature students from Birkbeck College who were working on some project that would involve questioning men in the street. The consensus seemed to be that one of the group, let's call her Denise, could do the questioning because she had nice breasts.
and I found myself having to try to explain to a group of complete strangers that I am no admirer of the enormous breasts apparently favoured by most men, but opt instead for more modest but sincere breasts, not unlike the ones I have myself, in fact. Can it really be but a week since I was last sprawled coquettishly on the Home Truths sofa, our microphone positioned so that the studio lights fall on my eager upturned face as I lean towards it to speak? Yes, it can and is. Hello and welcome to another Home Truths. And a special welcome to the rather elegant and well-turned-out man who stopped me in London's St. Martin's Lane on Wednesday afternoon to ask me what exactly it is that is said at the very start of Dick Dale, King of the Surf Guitars record, the one that's playing behind me. I told him, as I've told so many people in the past, that the words are, "Let's go tripping." Approximately 5 minutes before this, in Berwick Street, I'd noticed coming towards me a rather elegant and well-turned-out woman. She'd obviously noticed me too, and I sort of knew she was going to speak as we passed each other. I was expecting a, "Just want you to know how much I enjoy Home Truths. We never miss it." What I got was, "Hello, do you want to see the girls? Sex massage?" "Never judge by appearances," I murmured reprovingly to myself as I ambled on.
And that was The Faces with Cindy Incidentally, one of John's favourite bands. Characters were attracted to Home Truths like bees to honey. And Horace Prickett got in touch with the show, claiming to be the only person on the planet with that name. Well, it was too good an opportunity to miss.
Given the extraordinary number of people on the planet, oops, there's another one, and another. And people, reason insists, on other planets who, even though they speak to each other by rubbing the scales on their ankles together, must have names, that even if you're called Evangeline Moth Particle, there must exist the possibility that somewhere out there, there's another Evangeline Moth Particle. Having said that, here is Horace Prickett, and Horace reckons he's unique in all the world. According to electoral rolls, there are 500 or 600 Pricketts in this country, but only one Horace. And it was to that Horace I addressed my remarks when he came into our Trowbridge studio. I asked Horace pretty simple questions, but, as befits a lecturer and local politician, he answered at some length.
I know of no other Horaces, and having trawled the internet, which of course has made searching very much easier, to my surprise, I found I'm the only Horace Prickett. Lots of other Horaces,
oh,
and
there,
not
okay.
many
there,
more Pricketts.
Although it's, perhaps it's coming back, because I've got a grandson called Archie, and my brother's got a grandson called Hector, and these are names that would be of the same sort of period as a Horace.
Of course.
How about Prickett? Are there lots of Pricketts?
No, I think in the local telephone directory there are about three of us listed. Rickett, but also it occurs in Love's Labour's Lost, where in Act 2 Shakespeare refers to the Pricketts, which apparently is a buck in its second year when it's most virile and most useful to the does.
And did either of your names bother you, or the whole thing, as it were? Was it a problem when you were at school?
Yes, it was a bit embarrassing. Not so much when I was at school, that used to be taken care of, but when I was in my early teenage...
Well, in what way taken care of?
Well, because the teachers wouldn't allow me, people to take the mickey out of me and so on.
But
and,
in the playground, surely?
Yes, and that sort of thing. Mm. But I was never particularly conscious of it, but when I became a teenager and had left school and was having to introduce myself to many other people who didn't know me at all, and when I became a lecturer for the first time and had to introduce myself to large classes of giggling teenagers who were not particularly sympathetic, I used to write my name on the blackboard backwards. So that we obviously didn't have Prick to begin with.
But obviously now it's you don't have to put up with any nonsense from people.
Well, no, I don't get put up with much nonsense now. Mm. As a local politician, it's sort of taken on the chin. You get used to the fact that 90% of the people don't like you most of the time.
It does sound like, actually, now that you said that, it does sound like a local politician's name.
It does indeed, doesn't
it?
Well,
does.
I never have any problems when it comes to voting, you see. They won't find another Horace Prickett on the ballot paper.
I'd have thought not.
No confusion there.
But I understand that despite the fact that you're seeking retirement, you have a fiancé.
I have a fiancé, yes, that's right, yes. And that, again, is a very interesting story.
Tell us.
Yeah, back in the tail end of the 50s, very early 60s, I was one of the local young socialists organised and used to help run meetings. And I had this strange phone call 5 years ago to do with my job as a teacher. And to cut a long story short, it came, well, are you the Horace Prickett? And I said, yes, I think I'm probably the Horace Prickett you're looking for. And she said, well, many years ago, I used to attend your political meetings. But you were such a big head and knew all the answers that, in fact, I left and joined the Liberals instead.
That's not really the effect you were after, is it?
It was not the effect
I was after. Were you a bit of a firebrand then?
Well, I was then, yes. Well, I was a typical teenage know-it-all, do-it-all.
So this is, your fiancé was this person who was inquiring about Horace Prickett. And
that's how it all came about.
But your ancestors, Horace, do you know much about them? I mean, did any of them have problems with being called Prickett?
No, I don't think so, but there is another interesting story. My grandfather was one of 11.
Did you ever consider changing either parts of your name to something?
No, not at all. No, I have stuck with them, and now I'm quite proud of them.
Horace Prickett, living proof that there's more to a name than just a name. And although Horace could talk some, he's no match for Dick Dale, the guitar overlord behind our signature tune, who once spoke to me for 25 minutes on the cue, Hello Dick.
Okay, so I love the way John Peel talks to Horace there around what could be a slightly sensitive subject, but anyway. The Home Truths answer phone had a pivotal role to play, collecting listeners' stories during out-of-office hours.
Trace Elements, Richard, and Stella Hook would be pleased with you. Stella, you may remember, took me to task a few weeks ago for having paid for the elimination of a hornet's nest that was in our thatch. She's back again, after hearing a listener last week talk of crushing a stag beetle. She's back, as I say, and not pleased.
Well, there we are. You see, your programme seems to be giving us a daily list of things people destroy. Week before last, it was wasps. Now we've got somebody killing the most wonderful insect, this stag beetle. I mean, they are wonderful animals, those stag beetles. They'll never hurt you. Why don't step on it? Why not just pick it up and put it outside, for heaven's sake? All you've got to do is to put a glass over it, put a bit of paper underneath it, and then take it out and put it into the garden if you don't want to pick it up. Pick it up, it's not going to hurt you. Why don't squash it?
It wasn't me, Stella. I've never deliberately trampled on a stag beetle, knowing...
Let's launch ourselves into 2004 with Margaret Hopkins. Oh, hello. I wonder if anyone remembers personal hygiene. When I was leaving school in the late 40s, we were advised to use an antiperspirant called Odorono, I think, a pink liquid which would last a whole week. Can you imagine? No washing under the arms for a whole week.
Those are the voices that I miss, as well as John's, obviously. John's family was undoubtedly at the centre of his life, and they were included from the very first show.
My mum used to knit me jumpers big enough to house a family of asylum seekers. There was a sort of purple one she crafted that I wore for years. She'd had a crisis of confidence when she'd finished knitting a normal-sized jumper, so took up her needles again and added another 10 or 12 inches to it before losing interest and getting someone else to stitch it all together. The resultant garment, which is in a drawer upstairs if you want to see it, had a sort of waistline about three-quarters of the way down and looked like a dress. Yet I emerged from the jumper buoyantly heterosexual. I find it enormously amusing to drop hints to our children, no longer children, strictly speaking, but you know what I mean, hints, as I was saying, about their parents' shared sex life. Tell your mother, I bellow at them from the stairs as I head for bed, that I'm preparing to anoint my body with rich unguents and will be ready to pleasure her in 5 minutes. They just shout back, for God's sake, Dad, secure in the knowledge that the diabetes has removed me from the lists of love. But they certainly wince if we make any reference to the processes by which they were conceived. About the only domestic task for which nature seems to have equipped me is cork withdrawal. Otherwise, Sheila does everything and seems to have incredible strength in her apparently asbestos hands. Whenever she makes me a cup of tea, your tea always tastes much better than mine, I whine horribly. Sheila can hold the white-hot mug without flinching, whereas my delicate hands blister spontaneously even before contact is made. Having said this, I am quite good at carrying suitcases and stuff, and have recently discovered an unexpected talent for carrying grandchildren past dogs, specifically Nelly, an old English sheepdog, and Bernard. The scoundrels who sold us Bernard insisted he was a border collie, but if he is, he's the biggest that ever lived.
John was there to be himself and to talk about his own family and bring those stories in as well. And which, of course, he did, because he absolutely, absolutely adored his family. They were the most important thing to him in the whole wide world, and that was 100% true. There was nothing put on about it. And when he told stories about Sheila, the pig, or his sons and daughters and how they were getting on at school or not getting on at school or whatever, it was absolutely, absolutely genuine, and it was straight from the heart. And he was also passionate about any injustice in the world, you know? It wasn't just about his immediate family. It was about, you know, world issues and terrible things that were going on, and that would upset him too. But he would get very upset by people's stories.
What was John like away from work, you know? Was he a funny companion?
Oh, yeah, he was great. I mean, quite often we'd go out for an Indian meal. I mean, he was a vegetarian, but he loved his Indian food and he loved his red wine. And there was a particular little Indian restaurant we used to go to, which was South Indian and all vegetarian. You know, he'd sit there and really hold forth and just tell anecdotes. And really, you know, one did just sit there and listen to him because he was so funny. But he liked that. You know, he liked having a small group of people around him that he knew well, that he trusted, and that he felt at home with. And whenever we did this, he'd always bring along his two Radio 1 producers, because obviously he knew them very well. And I think he liked the idea of getting the posh Radio 4 people along to mix with the sort of slightly low life from Radio 1. But actually, we all got on really well together. And he used to give me little presents, which was so sweet. I mean, it was just music, but I was a great fan of country music. Now, you wouldn't have necessarily thought John Peel was a great country music fan. Actually, he was. And one day I came in, he said, here, and he flung a CD across. And he said, I think you might like this. I've been listening to it in the car. And it was by Laura Cantrell, who's this wonderful American country music singer. And I said, thank you, John. It was fantastic. You know, I still listen to it all the time. And another time he came in, because I'd been banging on about the Mafia or something, and said, you might like this. No, in fact, what it was, he had a CD of Mafia music and he copied it for me. I didn't ask, he just copied it for me. And little things like that, I mean, you know, it was they were really nice touches. I mean, not like going out and buying expensive boxes of chocolate, just something he had. He'd been given it and he thought, you know, Dilly will really like that. I'll give it to her. And that really touched me, actually. It's had me in tears at times when he sort of suddenly gave me a little CD and said, I thought you might like that, in a rather grumpy way.
Of your love, 2 seconds of your love is all I need of you. 2 seconds of your time, that's enough to say we're through. 2 beats of your heart is enough to know we'll never part. 2 seconds of your
was 2 seconds by Laura Cantrell. Now, John Peel said himself of Cantrell, "My favourite record of the last 10 years, and possibly my life, is an LP by a New York woman born in Nashville called Laura Cantrell. It's country, and I don't know why I like it, but it has the same sort of effect on me as Roy Orbison had in the 60s. Here's John with one of his Desert Island discs.
About 3 or 4 weeks ago, I was standing in the fog on Stowmarket Station, and there was nobody else on the platform waiting for the train into London, and the only light was very diffused light through the fog, and I was standing at the end of the platform, and behind the station there's an industrial estate, and very, very faintly and very tinnily from the industrial estate I could hear Roy Orbison's It's Over, and it was a magical moment.
All the rainbows in the sky then say goodbye. You won't be seeing rainbows anymore. Setting suns before they fall. Echo to you, that's all, that's all. After all.
Well, I'm glad John allowed me to get some Roy Orbison in. That's fantastic. But back to Home Truths. So fans of Home Truths will remember Brian Gallagher. He was a regular contributor, a born storyteller with a mellifluous Irish voice. Now, halfway through his very first contribution, John came out with one of his classic ad-libs. See if you can catch it.
And there were rumours about a broken love affair. And then gradually things had deteriorated into their present state. Mm. But one day, as I approached the house for the can of buttermilk, I heard her singing. And I stood near the dunghill and I listened. And she was singing in a sweet, quavering sort of a voice. She was singing, "I dreamt I dwelt in marble halls." Do you know that one, John?
I know by the title, but if you said "Sing It or Die, Fat Boy," I'd be in trouble, I must say.
If I just give you an idea of the first line of it. I dreamt I dwelt in marble halls with vassals and serfs by my side.
Well, John made Brian laugh, and he certainly made me laugh when I heard that. So it's those ad-libs that I miss. And here's John putting some of the contributors at ease.
I take it you're already recording. How unfortunate that is.
Hi, Lee. I'm John, and I should be the one who's asking you the penetrating question. As soon as I get this staple out of this piece of paper. How are things in Blackburn, then?
They're okay today.
The implication being that they weren't okay yesterday. Actually, I need to go and get a pen, so I've got to go away.
All right,
hold
then, okay.
On, 30 seconds.
Okay.
So, what is that?
Emily brought along a noddy toy for a little demonstration.
Oh,
she
I see,
just
okay.
Then accidentally leant on it.
Oh, so. I see, all right. No, I like the sound of that already. I'm back again. He's still there.
Right, I'm still here.
Okay, I think I put on one of my wife's jumpers this morning, too. Because I'm used to clothes not fitting me, but this one doesn't fit me by a factor of about 10. When I took the coat off, I felt as though I was wearing a bandage, not a jumper. I'm sorry about doing this to you. You're expecting
no,
display
no.
of competence and maturity.
Don't worry. I listened to your radio programme, so I didn't expect anything else.
I'm not sure that I should have to respond to that. Bordering on the impertinent, really. And I'm going to blow my nose, and then we'll start.
Great.
I'm an Arsenal supporter, so depths of despair.
You're still a young woman, though. No, you're fine as you are.
Okay.
If you get too close, it distorts. Yeah. And also, any kind of if you start tapping the table in a neurotic manner, that'll pick up as well.
Yeah.
So it'll sound like distant drum beats. So now that I've laid the ground rules,
okay.
In this rather authoritarian way. Yes, no fidgeting and pay attention.
I live in Chorley.
All right, okay.
Just outside Preston.
Okay. Well, Mum was a Preston girl.
Was she?
Yeah. I don't know what you're going to do with that information, but I pass it on to you anyway. I was listening to you describe how you got to the studio. Did you say you turned off at Basildon?
I know the way from there, and I thought I won't get lost.
But isn't Basildon in Essex, though?
Basildon, sorry.
Oh, okay, sorry. I thought, what kind of a loony is it that goes to Southampton by way of Basildon? You've been admirable, Anne. Thank you very much indeed. We've got the whole story down in one, and so there's that's it. You're discharged into the community. Thank you very much indeed. It's very
thank
kind
you.
Of you to come in.
Well, we're rapidly coming to the end of the show now, but here's a final word from Dilly on John's great talent as a broadcaster. John Peel's stature as a music DJ is undeniable, but he's unusual for making that crossover to sort of speech radio, Radio 4 as well. What do you think was his great talent for his success on Home Truths and interviewing ordinary people about extraordinary things?
I think it was because he was, John Peel was John Peel, and what you heard was what he was, and it was completely genuine, even if his scripts were beautifully crafted. It was almost the way he spoke, actually. I mean, he had a very elegant way of speaking, which I think partly came from a classical background. He was a real stickler for right grammar. I mean, if you'd written something that was ungrammatical or misspelt, he would tick you off for it in front of everybody. Oh, you misspelt this. So he had a great love of words and of writing and of humanity. It's very difficult to put your finger on what it was that made John Peel John Peel, but whatever it was what made the programme, I think, and what made him a really good broadcaster and a really good, in his own unique way, interviewer too.
Well, as a fledgling radio presenter, John Peel and Home Truths is one of my inspirations, and it's been fantastic trawling through the Home Truths archive. I hope you've enjoyed the selection, and I hope it's put a smile on your face. Coming up after the news is Marc Lefebvre with, he's going to be trawling back through the decades with some more music from the John Peel radio days. And he'll be followed at, well, no, he'll be joined at 7 o'clock by John Steele. And there's an interview there, a surprise interview with Chas Hodges from Chas and Dave. So that's between 7 and 8. And then from 8 to 9, we have John Steele. And from 9 till 11, Tony Gosling. And the evening continues into the early hours. But let me just leave you with John Peel.
It is to this modest cottage location that I will shortly turn the wheel of my unremarkable family runabout. But bear in mind, as I pass by, that in my heart and in my head, I am tousle-haired adventurer Jack Peel, gunning the motor of my Vombini V12 towards the acres of rolling parkland, the lakes, woods and rivers of the massive estate that I've bought with my record lottery win. Note my finely chiselled features, the taut lobes, the sparkle in my frank blue eyes, the flashing white teeth.
Any retakes at all?
No.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
FM. It is your voice and it is your choice.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol.